I know that everybody was excited as soon as he said, I'm doing the civil side. I mean, everybody really salivates over that one. But just a reminder, I mean, this is really a yeoman's effort that Mark and Marilyn do a great job. I mean, this year, of course, they start off by saying, hey, let's have fewer bills. And then it was a record. What, we had 500 and something bills that were passed. And so then Mark and Paul and their group get together. They have to go through all of those and see which ones are applicable to us. And then those get disseminated, to, as Mark said, for people to put them together. And then Mark has to get them back together. And he and Marilyn then have to get these to the publisher. And with the session just ending last month, that it's quite the effort. So we're going to go through this. And what I've done, I did this last year, and most of the feedback seemed to indicate that they liked it better, that you liked it better. So I'm not going to be going in order of the green book. The handout that you have, I've tried to group them by topic. So if it's not a topic that you care about, you can doze off till we get to the next one. And we'll go through this. The thing about it is that those of us that do this realize that communication and language is kind of an interesting thing. I mean, you know, we had a president who wanted to know a long time ago what is meant. And so we fight with definitions and with words. And then those of you that have are familiar with the foreign language realize that that even gets a little bit more complicated. And so there's going to be a few highlights that demonstrate that sometimes we have a problem with translation and communication. Now, those of you in the back that might not be able to see that, a lot of the comedic luster of this slide was diminished a couple of weeks ago. But anyway. And as you look at those, sometimes you can see how they got the hand part, but I don't have any idea how they called the fire extinguisher a hand grenade. But anyway, with that, this first section, we're going to be talking about the county authority, referendums, petitions, and form of county government. Now, just having gone through an ugly referendum, I wanted to talk about that a little bit. I mean, it was really kind of ironic. The people that were opposed to the zoning ordinance that we tried to put forward were really they claimed to be part of the Tea Party, and they wanted to make sure that government didn't interfere with their property rights, but on the other hand, they didn't want this property owner to do what they wanted to do on their property. So I thought that was kind of an interesting twist on it. One scary thing about, you know, that the Supreme Court has kind of opened up the doors for referendums, and the thing that concerns me about that is that how open it is, you could actually have your citizens adopt an ordinance that is unlawful, that subjects you to liability. And so it's something that, you know, we're going to have to keep an eye out for. The other problem is you cannot expend public funds to put forth your position with regard to the referendum. An example would be if your citizens decided that they did not want to allow group homes or residential facilities for the elderly in single-family dwelling zones, and they pass that law, well then obviously you'd be subject to all kinds of liability under the federal as well as the state Fair Housing Act. So, a referenda, have fun with those, and we'll talk about some of those. First of all, a county authority. This is House Bill 113. Basically, this formalizes an existing practice in that it allows the county to participate in coordinating efforts with the federal agencies. Again, nothing groundbreaking, but again, just a caution, when we have an existing practice, is there really a need to codify it? And I say that primarily because under the Hutchinson case in this state, we are a Hutchinson state, which means that if the legislature doesn't specifically address it, then it's something that we can do. But the more we get these ticky-tack rules in the statutes, then it seems we're heading more back towards being a Dillon state. And so we need to be careful with some of this legislation. Administrative hearings by counties. Again, another one of those things that you could have done anyway. Cities have been doing this for a while where you can handle a lot of your enforcement of your codes through an ALJ, an administrative law judge. You can do civil penalties instead of going through the criminal process. And like the city's provision in the statute, it says that you cannot use this for traffic violations. And as far as the county government amendments go, basically this allows the elected officials saying that they actually can go out and encourage and support activities and development for things that are beneficial to the community. The bill also clarifies the law by modifying currently undefined language relating to campaign contributions. And the effective date on that one is a little bit different. The effective date on that one is May 1. As it says in there, most of them become effective on May 14th, unless it's otherwise indicated in the handout that you have. County Attorney Chapter Recodification. This is really just called the We Trust Gavin Anderson Bill. Okay. And that was Gavin himself. Okay. Basically, Gavin drafted this, and so we thought, well, okay, we'll let it go through. And then Gavin also drafted the summary, so I don't have any way to question this at all. Trust me. He claims that all it does is reorganize and recodify everything that county attorneys could do. However, he slipped in a few ethical things that you might need to be aware of, right? Is it just the 25 sets of rules that we now have? Is that what it is? Okay, so he tried to reorganize it. The fact that he was gutsy enough to open up that provision for the legislature to mess with is impressive. But anyway, so that's that one, the county attorney. So again, supposedly nothing substantive other than the addition to the ethics part. Referendum petition form of government, particularly with regard to changing your form of government. This basically says in order to petition a change in the form of government, they've changed the formula. Okay, so it had the registered voters, to the number that's signing the petition has to be a number that's at least 10% of the total number that were cast in the last presidential election. It's tightened it a little bit because before that it used to be just the gubernatorial. And so hopefully that'll help a little bit with that one. And then I don't know how come you counties have found such a friend in Melvin Brown. Anyway, we'll get to a couple of his a little bit later. His basically, this one says that it simplifies the process for going from the alternate form back to a commission or the prior form of government. All right, and it's another one of those that those of you that like the math story problems, what the formula now is there has to, the petition has to be signed by registered voters equal to 15% of the number of votes cast in 85% of the voting precincts in the county during the last presidential election. So in other words, hopefully that'll be something that you can either foresee or support if you feel like the change of government needs to take place, your form of government. Next one is House Bill. Whoops, we're not there yet. There we are. Okay. This one I don't understand unless they mistook that the only thing we do is smoke camels, and camel and moose is as close as you could get. Anyway, elections and candidates. We had a ton on elections this time. House Bill 39, candidate amendments. This is basically the process for replacing a candidate who becomes ineligible, whether they die or become disqualified in the interim. So there's a process for that. Also a process for a candidate who maybe is out of the country or out of state during the filing time. You know, maybe they're away on they've been called up or something like that. They could still be a candidate. Also it discusses a form for filing for a write-in candidate. It also increases the filing fees. House Bill 44. Basically, this says that if someone is out there taking a poll and they're asking you what your opinion is, they have to disclose who's paying them to do that poll before they conclude the poll. Otherwise, they get dinged $100. So, election law amendments, House Bill 53. Basically, this is a guidance for the election officials when they're reviewing the absentee ballots. House Bill 64, this will help you sleep well at night. If someone is convicted of a grievous felon involving the sexual abuse of a child, they can't be on a local or state board of education. Those aren't the ones we worry about, at least according to Matt's presentation yesterday. House Bill 82, elections and early voting during a declared emergency. You know, just like we had the problem with Sandy hitting the coast last year. This basically gives the lieutenant governor some flexibility if there's a declared emergency, whether it's local, regional or statewide, there's some flexibility with regard to handling the election. And that's what that facilitates. House Bill 85, this changes the formula for determining when a recount will be made. The request for the recount must be filed within 3 days after the canvassing of a municipal election. Otherwise, it's 7 days after the canvass of any other election. If it's a ballot or a proposition that's on there, the same dates apply, but there must be a request by 10 voters for the recount. House Bill 204, some more election amendments. This basically adds to the timeliness or clarifies the timeliness of the filing of absentee ballots. The 262 unaffiliated voter amendments. This law before had a sunset clause. This basically gets rid of the sunset clause so unaffiliated voters can select a party anytime that they want to, I guess. And then election revisions 378. This is loosens the voter regulations. It addresses existing, if someone votes outside their precinct, and it also allows a provisional ballot to be accepted as voter registration. So they really have loosened a lot of the registration requirements. Municipal election amendments, basically this changes the deadlines just for a bunch of things. And so you'll need to contact your either city recorder or town clerk. It changes the deadlines for declaration of candidacy, for the clerk to certify the names of candidates, for write-in candidates, and also for members of or candidates for board, for local boards. All right. Not sure exactly what that means. I don't know if that's, pick up in the park after yourself or what. But obviously that means we're going to be dealing with land use. Impact fees, we'll also be dealing with property environment. And then there's a bill on RDAs we want to talk about, redevelopment authorities. And then there was just one eminent domain bill that we'll just briefly address. So land use and impact fees, land use amendments in House Bill 88. This is another one from our friend Mel Brown. Basically what he wanted to do here was he wanted to set it up that if somebody's property was involved in a rezone process, they could opt out. That would make things go pretty smoothly. That didn't happen, obviously. That was quite contested, but basically what it does do is it allows them to object, but then it doesn't do anything really more than what they can currently do. As the notes say on page 6, there is a drafting mistake where they talked about the municipality when they're actually talking about I think the counties, but be that as it may, I'm sure that most of the courts shouldn't have too much of a problem with that. So yeah, I don't know who made Mel mad, but anyway. This is another one by Mel Brown, boundary adjustment amendments. This basically just makes the process of adjusting boundary lines between property owners, simplifies that process, but this one only applies to properties that are unincorporated areas as well as not in a platted subdivision. There's already a lot line adjustment provision for those situations. Impact fee amendments, House Bill 224. Basically, this was a result because there were some developers that were complaining that, you know what, we get partway through the process and then all of a sudden the process changes. They come up with some different formulas, and so this, again, tightens our ability with regard to establishing what the impact fees are or adjusting them afterwards. We have to develop now a level of service, and that has to be part of the review that we do in creating the impact fees. And then, of course, it has a provision in there that a party may challenge or request a review of the study that's done in support of those impact fees. House Bill 236, land development revisions. This bill does two things. And this one was one of those where I read the summary and I thought, you know what, whoever prepared this summary didn't get it right. There's no way this is what the law says. And so I went and pulled the bill and it's right. Again, Mel Brown. It prohibits counties, this blows me away, from requiring landscaping or revegetation on a single family lot. after the building is complete, unless it's in a floodplain or a geological hazard area. So you just build a house and keep your dirt? I don't know. Anyway, kind of interesting. It also limits the county's ability to enforce if the development occurs contrary to the approved site plan. It also has some site plan provisions in there. So for you counties with your planners, you're not going to have a lot of fun with that one. And it only applies to the counties, not to the city. So I don't know how we dodged that bullet, but I'm glad we did. House Bill 357, Waste Management Siting. This basically says that if there's going to be a waste management facility sited, they've got to do a traffic study. And I don't know if the traffic study also has to do with the fact that they lose part of their loads or just a traffic study. And then if there's a solid waste facility that's owned by a local government, they're required to disclose the financial information regarding the establishing and operating of those facilities. House Bill 153, Local Government Development Amendments. This one does apply to both counties and cities. It's kind of a cleanup bill. For years in our state law, it has had restrictions both on group homes and elderly residential facilities as far as separating them and what kind of uses they are. That's been in violation of the federal, the state law has been in violation of the Federal Fair Housing Act for years. And so this is somewhat of an attempt to clean it up. There's still some problems there. I would encourage you that as you go through your land use ordinance, that you do not rely on necessarily the state's land use authorization, because some of those provisions are still contrary to the federal law. This bill also limits the ability of cities and counties to hold warranty bonds for longer than a year on infrastructure improvements, unless we can show good cause for it. Adds a definition of suspect soil, and it also requires that an exaction made for a third party actually be transferred to that entity for which it was exacted, which seemed to be pretty commonsensical, but apparently not. All right, and then we'll go over to this one, and this is one, another one that will help you sleep well at night. If you have property that has threatened or endangered species on it, then the county assessor, when he assesses your property, has to take that into account. So if you've got the spotted owl or some rare snail on your property, it will be assessed accordingly. The effective date on this one is not until January 1 of 2014. And then, of course, air quality mitigation. Basically, this refers to state agencies and school districts that are in Salt Lake, Davis, Utah, Weber, Box Elder, Cache, Duchesne, and Uinta counties. If that fits you, then you have to file a mitigation report, what it is that you're doing to keep the air clean in, by your agency, your entity, and in those counties. And we just had a single bill on RDAs this year, which was kind of nice, but it has some significant impacts. Basically, what it does, if you develop an RDA, those are funded by what they call TIFs, a tax increment financing, which basically there's a level of tax there that instead of the people paying it, they get to hang on to it, or it's funded by, or the funds go into the RDA. This does two things. First of all, it puts a cap on that. You establish a budget, and basically you can't go beyond that budget. The other thing is, if there happens to be a tax increase in the interim, generally, the RDA has been able to receive the benefit of that tax increase. That's not the case anymore unless they jump through some additional hoops. So those of you with the RDA, just be aware of those changes. Eminent domain. Couldn't believe there was really only one eminent domain bill this year, and it really didn't hammer us. It was actually a change. Some time ago, private developers were given some eminent domain authority. They still have some. But anyway, this took out one of those loopholes where they could build a street to an isolated area and get eminent domain, have the eminent domain authority to do that. So that one's done. This is, you know how in your hotels they have those, you know, have all those switches at the head of your bed? Well, this one is pretty interesting because one of the options there is smallpox, but not sure how that works. Employment and labor law. First one, House Bill 100. I think that we probably saw this one coming. This is the internet privacy deal. I know that a lot of employers, particularly law enforcement, when they would have an applicant that they were interviewing, asked them to give up their, you know, their password and to their private internet sites so they could see what kind of a person they were hiring. You can no longer do that, okay? That doesn't mean that you can't access that information as part of an investigation, but as far as their private stuff, it's private. Unless they're using the government's computers or accessing the internet through the government site, then there's some ability to do that. But as far as the initial employment part, you're not able to do that. And they've also made this apply to higher education. Anyway, so just be aware of that. Let your HR people know, and those that do the background checks for police hires, let them know of this new legislation. Workers' compensation, directors or officers, this is just kind of one, if you want to save some money on your premiums, you actually can elect up to 5 officials that you can remove from your workers' comp coverage. So, Senate Bill 83, this is the I don't like the Attorney General's office bill. I don't know what happened with this one. Basically, this is aimed at, it's called the Limitation on Employment by Government Employees, and it's aimed at executive state employees. I mean, and I haven't had a chance to find out. Sometimes we find out what the source of this is or the reasoning behind it, but anybody has a war story that they can share? But basically, I mean, that's what it seems, is that it was aimed at the executive branch, that they can't help other people and be compensated for it outside their own work time. Anybody have any better explanation on that than that?
Yeah, let's talk about it privately.
Okay. Anyway, so I don't know who got Mr. Weiler mad, but anyway. Whistleblower amendments, this is another one that just applies to state employees. This is on the other end of it. It basically makes significant changes in the area. Again, it does not employ the local governments, but probably should be aware of it because it could be one of those where the doors kind of open and they might go in. And so this really, excuse me, could impact you as far as your disciplinary process within your HR. Within your HR provisions, so be aware of that they've significantly expanded the whistleblower definition and the protections there. Volunteer worker amendment, this is actually one that helps us for a change, huh? Basically expands the definition of volunteer workers and expands our immunity in using volunteer workers for different projects, whether it be, you know, in your Parks and Rec program or cleaning up roads or whatever. Of course, retirement, with the big brouhaha from a couple years ago, they still have to do some tweaks. And so basically, this is more fine-tuning of the retirement overhaul. House Bill 24, basically it prohibits a public employer from making retirement contributions to, they say, the double dippers that exceed the normal cost for other re-employed retirees. Now, the double dipper phrase actually kind of offends me, and I had quite a heated debate with my father-in-law about this. And you know, I said, you know, what if someone went to work for, I don't care, Sears, and they worked long enough to get retirement, and then they decided to go and upgrade and go to work for Kmart and work there and got 2 retirements. Then they earned 2 retirements. He says, well, yeah. I said, well, that's the difference. He says, well, this is the public's money. And I'm going, well, they worked for it. Anyway, I still love his daughter, but anyway. I've never had a problem with this, and I think that, I'm preaching to the choir here as far as I think the unintended consequences of this is that, you know, we're losing a lot of experienced police officers as they leave the state. And anyway, so we lose that experience, and then, of course, then they take the Utah retirement money to another state, but off we go. And then this is another one that basically says that the employer is only required to make an amortization rate contribution to the employee who's been rehired. So if those situations impact you, then take a look at those. Okay, you probably can't see that one in the back. Basically, it says log in to work, all right? So I guess you have to automatic log in as you go through the right turn lane there. There, that's it. Is that more than just people on their phone, telecommuters? Okay, we have a ton of tax stuff, all right? And some of it's pretty nitpicky, so I'm just going to try to go through it so that you'll understand what they're doing. House Bill 54, this is for the Board of Equalization in each of your counties, okay? They've basically established some criteria for those that are on that board, okay? That for a hearing officer, they have to have some type of competency in real estate, finance, economics, public administration, or the law, and they have to pass a test developed by your county commissioners. So you might want to take a look at how that's going to happen, okay? And then it also identifies information that must be considered by the Board of Equalization, such as fair market value, sales price, sales offering price, those type of things. Now, it does create a bit of a problem for those of you that work with licensed appraisers, okay? It allows non-appraiser licensed representatives to offer price estimates and evidence in the tax hearings, okay? Those may be in violation of a larger standard and with regard to the opinion of value, and so there's going to be some complications with regard to how you're going to be able to use appraisers that are licensed and those that are not licensed. So there's some complications with regard to that one. House Bill 67, property taxation revisions. A few changes in there is that property owned by a landlord but used by a tenant can receive the residential exemption. It increases the personal property de minimis exemption from $3,500 to $10,000. Then there's a note in here that says this may be unconstitutional. So I don't know who would challenge that, whether a county would go challenge that, because I'm assuming that the taxpayer who gets an increased deduction probably won't challenge that. It allows the assessor to require first-time de minimis exceptions to fill out an application. After that, the assessor can only request a signed statement under penalty of perjury, but they can still do the assessment. That, again, has an effective date of next year, January of next year. House Bill 74, property tax modifications. This is one where what was happening is that, like, a farmer's out there, he's got open property. Someone else owns the mineral rights, and so they'd begin to exercise their right on the mineral rights. Well, then the county was coming back and saying, well, now you're not just using it for agricultural purposes, so we're going to do the rollback taxes. And this separates that. So those of you in the rural areas can be aware of that one. Let's see, the retention of sales tax by the collectors. This is one where they're trying to start to collect some of that internet sales tax that we're not getting. And so it's saying, hey, if you'll collect sales tax for us, we'll let you keep 18% of the sales tax that you collect for your administrative costs in collecting the tax and sending it back to us. So basically, it's one of those where, you know, again, the taxpayers will get dinged, and they're just trying to capture some of that lost money. We'll see how effective that is. This is the MIDA thing. Basically, it just authorizes MIDA, the military installation folks, to impose a resort tax, so that they can gather some monies, no different than counties or cities. However, they get to collect it even if it's on vacant property. All right, of course, that could be a resort in some of those places. Senate Bill 33, sales and use tax revision. This just basically exempts certain sales or leases if the ownership is under the same person. So it's just kind of, if you own two entities and you sell it to each other, there's an exemption there. Property taxation of business and personal property modifications. Again, this is one that basically increases that de minimis amount from $3,500 to $10,000. And again, the note on this one says that this one may be unconstitutional. Okay, for those of you that are the tax collectors, it changes from 45 days to 30 days, the time period in which a taxpayer has to pay their taxes, interest, and penalties after the court order becomes final. amendments to the sales and use tax. This basically says that, again, another effort towards capturing the money that we lose because of the internet sales. And so it's saying if Congress ever gets their act together, we want to participate and collect sales tax. Senate Bill 84, this is one of those that's supposed to help the travel industry. All the little daily consumables that they put in your hotel room, you know, the lotions, the shampoos, all that are now exempt from sales tax. I knew that would excite you. The summary says, so, you know, don't feel bad about taking those, but the towels are still not exempt, so please leave the towels. Senate Bill 124, another exemption. This is for databases. Basically, if you get a download a book and those type of things, they want those to be exempt. Senate Bill 171, this is kind of an interesting one. Basically, it allows some exemption for some particular electronic payment machinery. Basically, what the state's trying to do there is say, look, we're friendly to places like, you know, the electronic financial payment people like PayPal and Square and Stripe and those people, saying, if you come here, all your stuff is tax exempt. So it's kind of an invitation for that type of industry to come to the state. Senate Bill 238, property tax amendments. This simply allows the legislative body to reduce or refund taxes owing on property, even if a timely appeal was not filed, if they think it's equitable to do so. Again, a lot of these, and that's another January 1 effective date. Amendment to revenue and taxation, that's just an FYI. There was a case out of California that concerned the state tax commission, and so they repealed and reenacted the multi-state tax compact just so that we wouldn't lose funding there. Senate Bill 269, property tax revisions. This one was, the way that I read this one, it looks like it's just a reorganization. So it really doesn't do anything substantively unless I've missed it, but it does allow the taxing entity to go beyond the maximum levy rate. All right, going to finance. So celery phones, is that like on a Wi-Fiber network? I'm not sure how that would work. Anyway. All right, so some of the finance things. This first, the financial reporting amendment, basically this is for everybody, cities, counties, and the local taxing units. You need to notify your fiscal wizard that the reports need to have a certifying signature. Okay, that's really all that one does. Senate Bill 158, it's actually a good one. This is for cities, the rainy day fund. They call it the accumulated fund balance, but most of us call it a rainy day fund. We can now hold 25% as opposed to 18%. So that, basically with the way that the economy did the downturn, some cities that even had the 18% in reserve still got a little close with some problems. So that one was increased, so your city can hold back a little bit more reserve. Senate Bill 179, local government financial reporting revision. This basically changed the levels of revenue over expense that requires either a CPA audit or just a CPA review. So again, let your fiscal wizards know about that one. This one might be a little bit hard to see. You can tell it's on a toy. It's on the wing of a toy. And if you can't read that, I will try to read it verbatim. If blade damage, don't be fly. Otherwise, it will create the human body or blame damage. So, don't be fly. Okay? All right, bonding. This is just this first one. Sorry, I'm getting the double click. The first one basically is saying that you got to disclose additional information. You've either got to publish your resolution in its entirety, or it has a laundry list of things that need to be published. Again, we're just going for more transparency. Senate Bill 172, apparently Senator Valentine is concerned that locals are not using their bond money correct. Basically, any proceeds from bonds issued on or after May 14th of this year may not be used for operation and maintenance expenses for more than 1 year after the date that the proceeds were first used. And that also talks about the capitalization of interest. So you're limited, you got to be careful on the use of your bonding funds. And then this is another nice one. the state and its agencies, and it used to be all the political subdivisions, if we decided to appeal a judgment, we didn't have to post an appeals bond, okay? But now only cities have to if the judgment in the trial court was $5 million or more. So now we have to do appeal bonds. So I don't know who got mad at us on that one. I've got my suspicions. Okay, water, and I'll enlarge that one so you can see it a little bit better. Okay, so do not grow a hand in a fence. Stormwater capture amendments. This is one that they started last year. Just to let you know, you can regulate the capture of stormwater in your jurisdiction. That's one of the criteria. People can do it if it meets with the local ordinances. If it doesn't interfere with somebody else's water rights, it'll eventually end up in the ground. Won't be used for domestic purposes, which means, you know, your culinary water. And the storage capacity does not exceed 2,500 gallons, and a permit has been issued. Now, they don't have to have a permit if there are no more than two storage containers. They both have to be covered. I'm guessing that's because of Child Protective Services or mosquito abatement. One of the two of those wanted to make sure that it was covered. And it doesn't hold more than 100 gallons. So there you go with stormwater capture. 72, for those of you that have fluoride in your water, it actually now has to be quality controlled. So I don't know what you had before. They also changed the term from fluorine to fluoride. And so those of you that were worried about what you were having before, hopefully you'll rest at ease that you won't poison yourself while you're keeping your teeth strong. House Bill 73, water easement amendments. Basically, if you have a prescriptive easement to convey water across property, and if you want to abandon that easement, you have to go through quite a notification process. And I think that's in order to let other people that might be using that same easement, put them on notice so that they don't lose their ability to convey that water. House Bill 326 just requires the state engineer to consider any addendums or conveyances that have been filed in the county recorder's office. There's an ongoing struggle between the state engineer and local government with regard to water rights. And so we're seeing a lot of legislation on water rights, and I don't see an end to it. Water and irrigation. Basically, there was a forfeiture clause of 7 years. But if someone makes an application, then that 7-year period is tolled. And then Senate Bill 30 talks about the same thing, says that the 7-year forfeiture date had to have occurred within the last 15 years. In other words, they can't go back 16 years and then look at those prior 7 to see if it's going to be forfeited. Again, struggling with some of those losing the water rights. As you know, in this state, there's actually more paper water than wet water. And so this battle, as we grow, this battle is just probably going to get more intense. Senate Bill 101, so in other words, your entities ought to be getting your water, make sure it's wet water, not just paper water. Senate Bill 101, again, this is a notice procedures for the timing of filing of the change of use, points of diversion. Those things are further delineated. It's quite an interesting process, but make sure that, your application, the water rights that you have are real water, not paper water. Okay, now you're going to, this one was, this one up as well. I don't know, it's kind of fuzzy. And you maintain cleanness because greenery is our breath. If an egg to the snake, nothing fill, but if not a feed to public society. Man will not any control just one, a rope released donkey. This last one I think we can figure out. A pride man is below two pig. So anyway. So yeah, sometimes our language gets in the way of a lot of things. Utility facility sightings. This could also have been under the land use one. If a public utility wants to site somewhere in your jurisdiction and they don't like the regulations that you have on there, there is actually a utility facility review board that will basically sit down and mediate this. And they have the decision-making authority to kind of ding you and assess you if your requirements are inordinate. Anyway, so there were some changes with regard to that one. And so just be aware of that if Rocky Mountain comes to town. And then speaking of Rocky Mountain, this one is basically a negotiated bill, Senate Bill 180. There's a lot of cities and some co-ops out there that do their own power, independent of Rocky Mountain Power, some of the other power providers. And so if a city annexes additional property that might have been served by Rocky Mountain Power, then what's the transition for who takes care of the power? And so basically that's what this bill was to address, how and when the service will be provided after that annexation, the grandfathering of existing extraterritorial service, and the process of future extraterritorial electrical services. So if your entity has its own power, you're going to want to make sure that you're aware of that one. Special districts, and there was a lot of stuff on special districts too. All right, House Bill 66. This amends the provisions regarding the establishment of a local district and special service districts and special assessment areas. The protest period is made a uniform of 60 days, and protest thresholds are set at 25% of the total private land area and 15% of real property or registered, or 25% of the registered voters. So again, the establishment of local districts is being refined as well. House Bill 334, reorganization. A county that has established a special service district can convert that to a local district, and it provides that process. House Bill 348, the local district amendments. This requires the legislative body of a newly incorporated city to adopt within 180 days after incorporation a resolution approving withdrawal of the new municipality from certain local districts. So if the county has created a local district, city now there's a new created city that's in that area, they've got to go through the process of removing that from the local district. Senate Bill 140, again, this talks about the governance and formation of districts. It actually expands the authority because it can either be in whole or in part. Your county or the city doesn't have to entirely be encompassed by the service district. It also defines the membership of an appointment of the Board of Trustees. Senate Bill 200. This restricts the recreating of districts. If you dissolve a district, you can't recreate it for the same purpose. I don't know that that's happened, but apparently they were concerned about that one. Assessment areas. This provides the authority for counties, local districts, and service districts, and the MIDA folks, okay, to provide an energy efficiency upgrade or a renewable energy system and issue bonds for those. So again, it's an expansion of being able to do some financing for those. That would be a pretty good dessert, a lactic acid bar. All right. All right, and this is just FYI. Those of you that are in the south end of Salt Lake County are probably going to be losing one of your favorite landmarks. However, the rest of you may be having something come to your neighborhood. Who knows? Anyway, that was just talk. We'll see where that one goes. Mugshots. Of course, the sheriffs were not happy with the fact that people were making money off of their great photos. And it'll be interesting to see how that works out. Basically, it says that the sheriff may not provide a copy of the booking photograph if it's to be placed on a publication for a website, and the removal requires the payment of a fee or other consideration. So if someone just wants to post it along with their other advertising, it's okay. But if it's one of those where they're saying, if you want your mugshot removed, you have to pay me $75, and then you pay them the $75 and it doesn't get removed for a few weeks, not that I've had that personal experience, but anyway, then they can't. The press is not happy with this. They think that that's a violation of what it is that they can do. All right, this one was got to be close. So remember, tune in your radio if you are blinking. All right. Building codes. House Bill 202. Again, I did a double one. Sorry about that. Energy Conservation Code amendments. Just adopts the 2012 version of the International Energy Conservation Code. It also tweaks some language in the International Residential Code and the Energy Conservation Code. This effective date on this one is depends on when the other codes take place. So this is kind of a strange one. House Bill 310. This is the adoption of the uniform codes. So let your building official know that it's coming on board. The effective date on that is July 1 of 2013. One that's not in your outline, I apologize, is House Bill 217, the State Fire Code Amendments. Again, adopting the uniform code, but then it's adding several requirements. Probably the biggest one is requiring evacuation fire drills for secondary schools. They probably just need to do that on an early out day because I don't know that anybody would be coming back. It also modifies requirements for solar panels, pump and riser rooms, and automatic sprinklers. So just be aware of that one. And then of course, along with that is some fireworks amendments. Basically what this does is that it clarifies that it gives the locals, counties, cities, more authority in saying where and when you can blow up the neighborhood. So yeah, we actually bus people for this one in Layton, but anyway. Busted. Thanks, Gavin. Okay, Senate Bill 77. This is one that you're going to want to be aware of. This says that approved and pending recorded minutes need to be posted on the Utah Public Notice website within a relatively short period of time. I'm trying to remember what those days were. 30 days after the meeting to post pending minutes, 3 days after the minutes have been approved to post them, 3 days, yeah, and 3 days after the meeting to post the audio recording or a link to it. So this applies to obviously your local boards, your city councils, county commissions, likely planning commissions. So anyway, so again, your city recorder, town clerk, county recorder, whatever, whoever takes care of that is going to have to start posting those. And you might want to remind the people each time that it's going to be posted so that they're appropriately reserved in their comments. Senate Bill 283, basically this moves the Utah Transparency Advisory Board from the Division of Finance to the Division of Administrative Services. It also expands their duties and it includes their responsibilities to develop recommendations concerning making public information more accessible. So in other words, we're going to have more of this on the way, so just be ready. And with regard to grandma, basically I was surprised that this was the only grandma one that I found. Provides for accessible email repository for state legislators. And it did say repository, okay? Not sa, okay. Let's see. Okay, so be cautious. Just a couple of quick licensing ones. Construction trades licensing revisions. This puts a little bit more responsibility on your building official, whoever it is that accepts building permits. If someone is incorporated or they're an LLC and they're a contractor and they lose that status, they have a certain period of time within which to say what their status is going to be, or their license is automatically pulled. Whenever they come in to get a building permit, the local government is required to make sure that they show proof of workers' comp coverage, that they're paying into the unemployment insurance fund, that they are providing any required health insurance, and that they are withholding applicable taxes. So now we're also a gatekeeper for that responsibility. So anyway. Let your building officials and those departments know what's going on. Okay, this is a charity box. It's for especially difficult children, okay? I've had a few of those. I still have a few of those. All right, this is just kind of a gee whiz one. Alcohol service in restaurants, if you're worried about that. Instead of something having to order food, all they have to tell the server is that they intend to order food and then get a drink. So there you go. So a holy cow is not responsible for your vehicle, all right? It's actually the name of the church that the sign is in front of. Okay. All right, so liability, protection of athletes with head injuries act. Remember last year they said that if you've got a recreation program, you've got to go have your coaches and supervisors go through this training, and these are the procedures you have to go through if someone gets a thunk on the head, all right? Basically what this one does, it helps us out a little bit. It says that, okay, just because people are using your facilities, if it's not part of your program, you don't have to worry about it, even if they're paying for using your facilities. Okay, I will. I'll take a number two. It's a kind of a food. All right, procurement revisions. You'll recall last year that the legislature said, hey, cities and counties, if you don't have a procurement code, you got to follow ours. Okay, and this kind of says, well, you know what? It's, again, basically what it's saying is that the ethics provisions of our procurement code is going to apply to you regardless. Okay, and so we need to be aware of that, because another one of those where I was going to say the camel's nose in the tent, but according to this, it's the moose's nose is now in the tent. So the whole cow, the holy cow. House Bill 125, this really applies to you border counties and border cities. Basically, it gives the governor the authority to be able to work with the neighboring state if there's a problem. You know, kind of like how you can do an interlocal agreement now with between cities, counties, and those type of things. This is to go with our neighboring states and allows you bordering folks to do the same. So be aware of that one. Again, another one that we're probably already doing. And then the governmental task force basically, again, is talking about, let's see, where did I go with that one? It creates a government communication task force, which includes local government representatives to make sure that you have folks on there. It's to oversee and make recommendations regarding governmental radio communication systems dealing with public safety, transportation, and public works. And I thought we already kind of had that with UCAN, so I don't know if this is just a part of UCAN or something separate. Don't know yet. And of course, some of the fun things that we had, local versus the feds. If you, as a local entity, if you are adjacent to or in the vicinity of federal land, and there's a problem on that federal land that could cause you, adversely affect you, upon providing notice to that federal agency, and if there's inaction on their part, then you can remedy that situation under state law. Whether you can do that under the federal law, I don't know. But anyway, that's what the state law says. You give them notice of that condition that will adversely affect you, and then go from there. This one is a contingency plan for political subdivisions. Basically, it says that if more than 10% of your budget is based on grants or some other type of federal funding that you have, then you have to come up with a contingency plan in case that gets cut anywhere from 5 to 25%. So you need to come up with a contingency plan. The penalty for not doing so, there's not one. But anyway. And then expungements. This is kind of an FYI. Even if someone gets their records expunged, it can still be used by the Board of Pardons, Post, DOPL, State Office of Education, and federal authorities. Okay? And that is really all I have.